It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in a few moments, our guest says transparent government is vital to a thriving democracy, and citizens need to work to make it happen.
First, do we live in the best state in the country? Well, Gallup released a new survey asking citizens whether they think their state is the best or the worst to live in.
And so some states out west came in toward the top of the poll. Montana, number one. Alaska, number two. We had Rhode Island and Illinois at the bottom. Where's Wisconsin, of course, is what we're wondering. We are number 21, Veronica, right in the middle.
Middle of the pack.
Yeah. So 49% of us.
Get it?
The pack.
Huh?
Oh, well done.
Thank you.
49% said we're the best or one of the best states to live in. This is Wisconsinites talking. 8% said the best. 2% said it's the worst. Now, here's the thing, though. Most of the data was collected before the winter.
Oh, see?
Do you think that changed anybody's mind?
Are you kidding me? Were you here this winter?
They're gone. I'm still here.
Yeah, I'm still here, too. So maybe not.
So we want to hear what you think about this. You can go over to the Central Time Facebook page and share your thoughts on why Wisconsin is the best or the worst state to live in. Well, coming up, National Prescription Take-Back Day is tomorrow. We'll look at local and statewide efforts to safely and easily dispose of our expired prescription drugs.
First, politicians often applaud the idea of transparent government, but do they put it into practice? And how can we measure government transparency? Our next guest says the answers to those questions are vital to the future of representative government.
Donald Gordon joins us now. He's a longtime community activist. He teaches political history and civic engagement at Northwestern University. His new book is Transparent Government, What It Means and How You Can Make It Happen. Don, welcome to the show.
How are you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Well, a lot of people might hear government transparency and think, that sounds nice. Yeah, we need that. But it's not something that maybe fires people up. Why should citizens be worried about government transparency?
Well, to address the first point you just made, which is it doesn't necessarily fire them up, the problem we have to start out with is really coming to an agreement on a definition of transparency in government. And a lot of what we get is just simple disclosure, which can be really boring and really doesn't get people, active and engaged, because it's just, you know, a bunch of facts thrown out there that's very hard sometimes to sort through. One of the things I use in my course as an example is I take them on to the Illinois Board of Elections site, where there's a great deal of disclosure that's mandated in the state of Illinois. But when you start sorting through the Board of Elections site and all the information that's out there, it's really hard to bring about any meaning to it, much less to get people excited about it. So the first thing we have to do is, in the first chapter of the book, addresses the point of coming to an agreement on what we really mean by transparency in government. And
well, let's pursue that point. It's not just a data dump. But what are you looking for in government transparency?
Well, one of the things I try to simplify too is that I draw an analogy to a house being built, and I try to make the distinction so that it's clear in the first chapter between disclosure and transparency. In disclosure, you're basically got the foundation to the house, but you don't have a house. You can't live in the foundation. You can't enjoy it. It certainly doesn't get you excited looking at a foundation. And transparency is the house that's built upon that foundation. So, you know, when you look at it that way, disclosure is to transparency as the foundation is to a house. And to bring a little bit more into that, is what we have to do, and I've used an acronym primarily to get my students to remember it, but certainly for citizens as well. I've used an acronym that that goes like this. You have to ace disclosure in order to get to transparency. And what that means is you have to make the information that you're disclosing accessible, so it's got to be easy to get to. You've got to make it comprehensible, so when you're looking at it, you know, the average person can understand it. You don't need a degree in political science to understand what you're looking at. And the last thing is, and what we seem to miss, is that it needs to be enticing. In other words, the information needs to grab you, at least some of it. You know, everything that's out there isn't going to grab you. You're not going to get excited about everything that goes on in government, but everybody has their, you know, their hot button. And when you go and look at this information, if it's truly transparent, it's going to get you excited. It's going to, in a lot of cases, it's going to cause what I call civic enragement. But in the end, it leads to civic engagement. And if transparency, if the information that's put out there doesn't lead to civic engagement, you really don't have a successful implementation of transparency in government.
Well, if I'm working in a government office and you're telling me, hey, I want you to make information accessible, comprehensive, and exciting for people to get to that's going to really make them mad about what I'm doing, how do we get somebody in that government office to do those things?
One of the things I mentioned in the books, I go through some of the hurdles, the government hurdles, the citizen hurdles in getting to transparency in government. And the biggest hurdle in government to establishing true transparency is the culture in government. We are still, for the most part, there's very few areas of government where, other than maybe in Washington, where we've got a directive from the president back in 2008 to establish more transparency and defined it. But for the most part, the culture in government is still a 20th century culture. The culture is still wrapped around the foundation of the FOIA process, Freedom of Information Act process, being the driver for delivering information. And, you know, FOIA laws were started federally back in the late 60s and then implemented by all 50 states. At a time when communication was far less than what we have today. If you wanted some information, if you wanted to file a FOIA, you basically went down to a government office. They made a bunch of copies or they gave you microfiche, and that's how you got your information. Today, you can sit at your laptop, even your phone, and just click a button, and you can get access to information. That culture to be able to implement that kind of transparency still doesn't exist in most government agencies. Most government agencies are still in what I call that FOIA era, where it's based on you having to deliver, in effect, a note from mother in order to say, hey, I should get that information. And it also brings up another issue, which is we are our government. It's sort of a Zen thing, right? I mean, we're controlled by our government to some extent, but we also are our government. And all that information that's out there that government has is our information. You shouldn't need a note from mother to ask for that information. Now, there are cases when, obviously, you don't want to disclose, government shouldn't be disclosing information for a variety of reasons. They can make a case for it. There might be ongoing investigation, and you don't want to release information yet. There may be a security issue, nationally or even on a state basis. We don't want to release it. But at some point, that information should be released. And we really haven't, as a society, come to grips with the fact that that information truly is indeed ours. And really what we need to do is, at this stage of the game now in the 21st century, is turn FOIA on its head. And in effect, make a case for why information shouldn't be released, and otherwise the information should be made available.
I want to get into what kind of information you're envisioning government making accessible, comprehensible, and enticing, and having out there for us to access.
When you take a look at, and get back to the definition it came to in the book, but what we're looking at is not just the facts and the figures, which is often what you see, but also the mechanisms and processes behind that. So in other words, when you see data that's out there, there are times when you're looking at that and you want to know, well, how did you come about in arriving at this? A budget, a municipal budget, is a really good example of that. The best you get today in a lot of cases, and like we have here in Chicago, is you get the 200-page PDF document of the budget. And, you know, God help you if you can get through that and figure out what's where in that budget. But even given that you can get through that, those are simply the facts and figures. You know, what were the processes that came about in arriving at that? And you might hone in on, let's say, maybe garbage pickup. And we just recently went to a grid system in Chicago. and you take a look at a municipal budget, you take a look at what it's costing to pick up garbage, and you want to look at the information behind it. That may be your thing. You, for whatever reason, that may be your hot button. You know, I'm really tired of how garbage is getting picked up. I think it's a waste of money. I spend too much of my taxes on it. That may be your thing. You should be able to go behind the facts and the figures that you might see in a budget, for instance, and say, how did you come to these decisions that, for instance, that we should be on a grid system? Maybe that's not the right idea. Those processes, the mechanisms in arriving at how government is done, also needs to be available. Not necessarily because everybody's going to be looking at it, but because some people will, and that should be available to them.
We're talking to Don Gordon about his new book, Transparent Government, What It Means and How You Can Make It Happen. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation with Donald Gordon, author of Transparent Government, What It Means and How You Can Make It Happen.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What would you like to know about what your local, state, or national government is doing? How would you like to be able to access that information? Our guest is saying, hey, we need to flip things around instead of us having to ask for something and make our case for it. The government should have to make a case for what not to reveal. Again, you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. Don, you quote an interview, an extensive interview with Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, making the case that sometimes government officials need non-transparency. They need to be able to have an open and honest behind-the-scenes conversation without worrying how, you know, the public's going to spin what they're saying in that closed-door sure. session. What do you say to that idea?
He made a point which I think could be valid to some extent, and you can even carry that over into, you know, the private sector. You know, you have to at least be able to have conversations with people and not expect that there's going to be a microphone next to you and all of it's being broadcast real-time. So I don't have an issue with his response in that interview that he needs to be able to carry on a conversation. The point, however, is that at some point of time, that information should be accessible. So he needs to make a decision. He needs to have time to work with his staff in private to be able to come up with solutions. Sometimes there's contractual obligations with vendors that they have to deal with. So they need some time to be able to do this outside of the public eye. But that information on how that process worked, and whether it be his emails, his go around through the office, or the minutes of those meetings, at some point, that stuff needs to be released. And the reason I'm saying that as well is because one of the key factors in why people are just get fed up with government and just become apathetic is that they see their government as a black box, and that stuff goes on behind closed doors. They have no idea, you know, why things are happening the way they're happening, and they're frustrated with the fact that they're never going to find out, that these things are going to happen despite them. And this is what one of the key factors of what stymies civic engagement. If we want to drive people to become civically engaged, we have to inform them. If that information is done properly, it can empower people. It can motivate them to become involved. You know, Dewey once said that voting is simply a culmination. It's a culmination of people being involved prior to going out to vote. You don't wake up one morning and say, "Oh, it's a beautiful day. I think I'll go out and vote today." You go out and vote because you've been driven to vote. You've had motivation to do that because you've become involved, whether it's with, you know, maybe in a campaign or with a particular candidate or on an issue, and it gets you out to vote. If we want to increase voter turnout in this country, and God knows we need to do that, then we need to do the hard work of getting people engaged in their day-to-day activities in their neighborhoods and in their cities. And to do that, they've got to get information. We as citizens have to have the information, or it's going to be very difficult to be able to motivate people to become engaged.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Graydon with us in Milwaukee. Graydon, hi.
Hi. One of the major concerns that always comes up for me whenever I talk about transparency is how money moves around during elections. So if And I see it as a concern because we keep on relaxing our regulation for how, you know, money is donated to our political candidates. And I want to be able to have that information provided for me so that I know if a politician gets donations from a super PAC or something, and then he makes policy decisions or puts money into the hands of certain government contractors or whoever, I think that's information I need to know.
Graydon, thanks a lot. So a couple things there, the campaign finance, but let's start with the second point, being able to track where government money goes when it's spent on private contractors.
Yeah, there's the campaign finance issues actually was being addressed going back a while now. And a lot of that information is out there. Some of it just is simple disclosure, as I said before, which is hard to navigate through. But there are sites that are out there now, sites like OpenSecrets.org, where they've taken that information and reformatted it in a way to make it comprehensible so that you actually can and plug in your, you know, your congressional rep, and you can see, you know, who's contributing to your congressional rep and the industries that are contributing to your congressional rep. So that path that we're going down is really starting to open up it, more in federal elections, though not necessarily in state elections. And that's really where we need to have that kind of transparency, is in state local elections, because there's over 500,000 elected offices in this country. And of that, less than 1,000 sit in D.C. and in state offices. All the rest are local campaigns. So it would really help if we had that information in a comprehensible form, going all the way down to the local elections. As far as the second part of this, I mean, there's when we talk about campaign finance and money in politics, we're really getting even beyond the issue of just simple transparency. I mean, we're really starting to deal with the issue of, how do we develop our system, our political system, to mitigate the need for money to run for office. And that's a whole nother book.
Let's go to another caller. We've got Karen with us in Prairie du Chien. Karen, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions. One is, you brought up the fact that the government works for the citizens. And it makes me wonder, in that case, why there even are closed-door sessions. Yes, we can rely on the minutes, but can we trust them? Even if it's a contractual thing, hiring someone to fix a school parking lot, we should have input in it.
All right.
My second point is, a lot of the financial information is out there, but it's so subject to spin.
All right, Karen, thanks a lot for bringing those up. Backing up a lot of what you have said, Don, just a little bit of time left now. Do you see governments moving in the right direction, local, state, or federal government, on transparency?
I absolutely do, and I think that's why it's important that we come to some agreement in defining what it is transparency is about, because every campaign in this country and every politician who runs for office is dropping the word transparency when they run. And, you can have 1,000 different ways to look into this. We really have to come to some agreement on this. And it really is just a lot more than just simple disclosure. And that really needs to happen. Now, the second part of this is that I'm from the boomer generation. I have a lot of confidence in the next generation coming through, our kids, the millennials in particular, which is actually a larger generation than us, well over 80 million. And I have confidence in them that as they become, and they are now becoming candidates, running for office, working for government, that their expectations and their culture will change how we do government, and will make government much more open. And I'm very optimistic about that. And maybe that's because I see that every day with students But I also see it in my community, and from community organizing, I see that in the younger people in the community, and this attitude that, you know what, we want our government open, we want to know what's going on. You know, I talk in the book a lot about...
Actually, Don, I think that'll be a good place to leave it. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, you're very welcome. It was good talking to you.
That was community organizer Donald Gordon. He's author of the new book, Transparent Government.
Coming up, tomorrow is National Prescription Drug Take-Back Day. We'll find out how it works and why it's important for people to dispose of prescription drugs safely. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we fire up the grill and try our hand at grilling brilliant burgers.
But first, tomorrow is National Prescription Drug Take-Back Day. If you have outdated and unused prescription medications in your medicine chest, this is an opportunity to get rid of them safely.
Prescription drugs are linked to an increase in drug abuse and environmental concerns like contaminated drinking water, so health officials are urging people to dispose of them properly.
With this now, we have Dana Bruick. She's spokesperson for the Wisconsin Department of Justice, which is coordinating statewide efforts around the day. We also have Mark Lovicott from the UW Police Department, which held a take-back drive this morning on the UW campus. Dana, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us. This is an important issue. We appreciate you getting the word out.
Yeah, and Mark, thanks to you as well.
Glad to be here. Thanks for the opportunity.
Dana, let's start with you. How does National Prescription Drug Take-Back Day work?
Well, this is something that the Wisconsin Department of Justice has promoted for a number of years. The DEA Heads Up organizes this take back. It's held twice a year, each year in the spring and in the fall. And it's really an opportunity for people who may have medications just sitting in their household medicine cabinets to dispose of them properly and search online for a collection site near them by their zip code. We know that prescription drug abuse is the nation's fastest growing drug problem. We also know that heroin abuse is likely driven, at least in a big way, at least in part, by these addictive opiate-based medications that, if they're left sitting in household medicine cabinets, they're at risk of being diverted, being stolen for misuse, and thereby abused.
So the Department of Justice, the DEA, are hoping with these events, we get these opioids in particular out of medicine cabinets, reduce that temptation.
That's right. And Wisconsin historically has done very well at these take-back days. We have been in the top five in the volume of drugs collected, and that's incredibly impressive when you consider we're right up there with California, Texas, and New York. So we hope to keep the trend going, and we appreciate you folks helping us get the word out about how important this is.
Mark, the UW Police Department, as we mentioned, held a take-back event. It just ended. How did it go?
You know, and Dana alluded to this as well. We had a record-breaking day. We had a beautiful weather and a lot of walk-ups today, and that's what we were hoping for this event. You know, we hold our event a day earlier typically because we want to take advantage of those folks who may be downtown for work or for whatever reason and may not be able to get downtown because of something going on the weekend. We also have Crazy Legs happening tomorrow in the Madison area, so we decided to move it up a day, and we usually see huge success, and we did. Last year, we collected almost 90 pounds of medications, over-the-counter drugs and prescription medications. We just wrapped up, and we just weighed everything, and we collected 182 pounds. This
wow.
year. And when you think about it, those little tiny pills, in which most of these are, that's a lot of drugs. And that's a lot of drugs who are out of the hands now, which are out of the hands rather now, of potential people who shouldn't have them. So we're really excited and happy about how well our event went this year.
This is a question I've been asking myself for years. What do I do with these medications? Is that the response you get from people saying, thank you, I had no idea what to do with these things?
Most people don't know. And, you know, in years past, people were taught, you know, just flush them down the drain or flush them down the toilet. And there's obviously a lot of environmental concerns about that. And this is a great way for individuals to collect whatever they've been holding on to for whatever reason. And we'll take them, we'll get them to the proper people who can dispose of them properly. And, you know, we ran into a woman today who has clearly has been holding on to her medication for a long time. One of her medications expired back in 1963. So these are individuals who have had them
wow.
quite a long time in their medicine cabinet, and we're glad they finally got them to us.
Dana, people might be listening now thinking, hey, I want to do this. How do they find out where to take the medications in the next day or two?
Well, I would recommend that they visit the Wisconsin Department of Justice website, which is, of course, www.doj.state.wi.us. And there's a prescription drug take-back button, I like to call it, right on our homepage in the center of the page. You can't miss it. You click on that, and we have a short description of the event tomorrow and a link to the DEA website, which allows you to search by zip code or by, you know, your community. And it'll pull up law enforcement agencies that are serving as collection sites. And we have more than 200 collection sites tomorrow in Wisconsin. So in all likelihood, you'll be able to find somewhere that's near you. And if not, then you could still call your law enforcement agency and say, I have these, you know, what can I do with them? And they will likely give you some good advice. But I'd also like to point out that folks may think, well, I do have some, you know, unused prescription meds, but, you know, I can't see anyone coming in and taking them or, you know, whatever the case may be. But I just want to share one stat which says that more than 3 out of 4 people who misuse prescription painkillers use drugs prescribed to others who may be unaware that their drugs are missing. We see that, you know, parents may have, you know, have had a surgery or a procedure or, you know, needed pain relief, and they'll have prescription drugs sitting in their household medicine cabinets, and they may be unaware that, you know, a relative, a friend of their child or their child, has taken those prescription drugs. They may not be even aware that they've gone missing.
And Dana, people might be thinking, I've got prescription drugs that I'm not technically supposed to have. Maybe they're from an old roommate or something like this. Is this a no questions asked sort of scenario?
It's free. It's anonymous. You bring them, no questions asked, and the law enforcement agency will take them. Over-the-counter meds, prescription drugs. Yep.
And Mark, maybe people miss this event. They've got these drugs in their house next week, the rest of the year. Yep. Is there a way, if they miss the event, to still get rid of them?
There is. We have a great partnership with Safe Communities of Madison-Dane County, and they helped us obtain a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week med drop box, which is actually located in our lobby. So any time of day, if somebody wants to come over to the University of Wisconsin-Madison Police Department, they can do so, drop their medications in the box, and we'll get rid of it properly. Folks can head to our website, which is uwpd.wisc.edu, and we've got a link right on the front there about this drug take-back day, but there's also a link within there that they can search for 24/7 med drop boxes around their area, because they're all over the place. They're starting to pop up more and more because law enforcement agencies are realizing that, you know, this is a valuable tool to help keep these drugs out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them. So let's have this tool available to folks where they can drop it off all the time. We've seen huge, huge numbers of people coming into our lobby to drop these off, and we encourage people to do so if they missed it this weekend.
And the hope, if people get these drugs out of the system there, they won't start taking them and ultimately end up on heroin. Thank you both so much for telling us about this program. Dana, thanks to you.
Thank you.
And Mark, thanks to you for joining us as well.
You bet. Thanks, guys.
We've heard from Dana Bruick from the Wisconsin Department of Justice, Mark Lovicott from the UW Police Department. For more info on National Prescription Drug Take-Back Day, as Dana mentioned, you can find a drop-off site at the Department of Justice website. We've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page. You can check it out there.
Up next, grilling the perfect burger for Food Friday after we check in with Michael Leland for a look at headlines. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. The weather is slowly but surely starting to get nicer around the state, which has a lot of people itching to get out there and start grilling.
And so we thought now might be the perfect time to talk about grilling for Food Friday. Jamie Proviance is with us. He's the author of several cookbooks, including his latest Weber's Big Book of Burgers. Jamie, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thank you. Great to be here.
Well, in Wisconsin here, we're just at that point in the season where we're itching to get grilling. Maybe we're jumping the season a little, but everyone I know is just dying to get grilling. It's been a really long winter. So what do we need to do before we start using them for the first time after months?
Yeah, you got to pull the grill out, take the cover off, and clean it up a little bit. you know, brush that grate really well. It helps to do that when the grill is super hot. And then if you're using a gas grill, you know, it's a good idea to check all the connections, make sure you don't have any leaks. What you do is you turn on the gas, you put a little bit of soapy water wherever the connections are. If you see bubbles, then that's an indication you got a leak, so you need to take care of that. But otherwise, it's surprisingly easy, you know, just a little cleanup and you're good to go.
So the grill's up, we are ready to rock, and a lot of people go straight to the burgers. Let's start with the basics. Beef. What's the best kind of beef to buy when we're making that burger?
Well, I like chuck, and I like particularly a loose ground chuck. I think it has a great beefy, you know, meaty kind of flavor. Sirloin is good, you know, brisket is good. What you want to avoid is what's called hamburger at the store, okay? Because that really is just a mishmash of leftover stuff that doesn't really have necessarily the depth of flavor. You're getting scraps.
So if I want to make a hamburger, the one thing I should absolutely not buy is the meat called hamburger.
Exactly. It should at least be called ground beef, because by law that can't include any fat scraps or other questionable material. And if you can get something that's pure chuck, preferably with a good amount of fat in it, you know, an 80-20 blend is nice. That means it's got about 20% fat. That's really important for the flavor and the juiciness of the burger.
So I haven't eaten beef in years, but I have to say I was just looking at your cookbook and the beef section going, maybe I want a burger. They look really good. Can you tell us about, for instance, the smoked Gouda barbecue burger?
Oh, gosh. All my favorite things, you know, beef and smoke and cheese. That's just the way my mind wanders sometimes. You put those things together and, you know, you're happy, I guess, even if you're a vegetarian. But you notice I do have quite a few vegetarian burgers recipes in the book and a lot of other surprises as well. There are fish burgers and chicken burgers and, you know, lamb burgers and... burgers are really not what they used to be, even 5 or 10 years ago. They've gotten much more interesting in their variety, and I think better in quality. You know, burgers have kind of gone gourmet lately.
I want to get more into veggie burgers in a bit, but as a stopping point, I like to cook with ground turkey. I got to say, when I do a burger with really lean ground turkey, it's a really boring burger. What can I do to rescue it?
Well, that's a good question. There are a few things to keep in mind. First of all, you're going to have to add something to the ground turkey to give it some juiciness, you know, some moisture. It doesn't have to be unhealthy. It could be, for instance, very finely chopped or grated vegetables. Onions or shallots or garlic work really well because they have these natural vegetable juices that make the burger moist and also, you know, delicious. You can also use condiments like, you know, Worcestershire sauce or soy sauce or something like that. You could use a little bit of egg in there. That helps and bind it maybe with a bit of breadcrumb. And then you just have to be really careful in the cooking of the burger. You want to make sure that you don't push out whatever juice is in there because there isn't a whole lot in there. So whereas a beef burger might be done over a high temperature, turkey burgers tend to be done over a more moderate, you know, medium temperature. And another thing is don't make them too thick because then they take too long to cook and all that time on the grill has a tendency to dry them out. So get them down to about 3/4 of an inch thick, medium heat, provide a lot of moisture up front, and they should be great.
So I've basically made my turkey burgers exactly the wrong way. I think I just hit every no-no that you listed for us.
Well, hey, that's you live and learn, right? Now you're set for the season.
And what about ground beef? Does everything you just told Rob to rescue his turkey burgers, does that hold true if you're cooking with ground beef?
Well, generally, yes, but you've got just a lot more margin to work with ground beef. So I do like to make them about 3/4 of an inch thick so they're not on the grill too long, although I do crank up the heat a little bit more for a beef burger because I want to get that char on the outside. I think that's part of a truly great burger. You know, where you have this contrast between that charred, you know, brown, almost crust on the outside, and then the really soft, juicy meat inside. But you can also add all kinds of flavorings to the ground beef. Not necessarily for juiciness, because you've already got that in most cases, but just for extra flavor to make it more interesting. I think a plain beef burger can border on dull unless you've got some stuff in there. So why not add, you know, fresh herbs, a little bit of mustard, you know, maybe some smoked sea salt, you know, some sort of interesting ground spices. It's just more exciting.
Well, I'm really interested in that beef burger now, and I want to experiment with that. But let's turn to some of those veggie options you mentioned. I think I saw something made with chickpeas in the cookbook.
Yeah. You can use all kinds of beans, chickpeas, pinto beans, cannellini beans. They all work really well. Typically, they're bound with some sort of a grain, maybe like some quinoa, or just some breadcrumb, but they tend to be very delicate. These are burgers that are sort of, they have to be moist going on for the same reasons that the turkey burgers have to be moist going on, because if they're not, they're going to be dry in the end. So you make them kind of wet, and that makes them a little more delicate on the grill. That's harder to turn them.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a couple of tips there. One is you actually want to refrigerate them for at least a half an hour or so before you grill them. That tends to firm them up a little bit. You still have all the moisture, but they're a little firmer and they hold together better. And if you really want to play it safe, put a griddle down on your grill, just like a cast iron griddle, or just use a cast iron skillet. And then it's going to be a lot easier to turn those vegetarian burgers or burgers made with beans because, you know, they just don't hold together like beef does.
Jamie, what is your favorite non-beef burger in this book? Because you've got so much. You've got fish going on, I think some turkey and lots of veggie burgers. What is your go-to when you're not cooking with beef?
You know, one of my favorites is a fish burger. It's actually the smoked salmon burger it's served with a fried egg on top, which I always love. It's got a little scallion cream cheese thing. It almost looks like a brunch item, although I eat it for dinner all the time. And it's fresh salmon that's just pulsed in a food processor and then bound with a little bit of finely chopped smoked salmon, a little bit of egg, a little bit of breadcrumb to hold it together. Again, it's sort of my favorite stuff. It's the smokiness of the salmon. It's the char of the grill, and you got this decadent, you know, egg that you cook just ever so slightly, so the yolk just kind of spills into the burger, making almost kind of a hollandaise type sauce. And then the cream cheese on the toasted, you know, muffin. It's just a really delicious, delicious item to do. Kind of a surprise if you're throwing a barbecue. You know, I always tend to do some traditional beef burgers, but I like to throw in a few surprises as well.
Yeah, it sounds pretty fantastic.
Yeah, you got to come out here, Jamie. I can't visualize this. You got to come out here and
we
make
don't
one of these for
it.
Us. Yeah. Yeah, we're simple folk. you know, in Wisconsin, let's turn away from burgers. We love our brats here. Any tips, any advice on grilling the perfect brat?
Wow, I'm humbled that, you know, somebody from Wisconsin is asking me about brats.
Wait, I'll tell you, you're going to start 50 arguments at least with your answer,
I know what it is. I know it. You know, I defer to the experts here. I've been there and tasted some phenomenal brats in all kinds of environments, parking lots and nice restaurants. And, you know, I think just the sort of the slow cook over a low to medium heat until you get that char. It's kind of like the burgers again, where there's a contrast between the outside and the inside. And then, you know, plenty of just, you know, grilled onions or pickles or whatever you like. This is not complicated food. You know, it's popular because it's been so good for so long. I do have a couple of surprises in the book, or not surprises, I suppose, but just variations. You know, I do one brat recipe with a chow chow. I don't know if you know that, but it's a southern dish. It's basically a fresh pickled dish made with corn and tomato and some onions, and it's like a relish that just goes on top. So it's an alternative to, you know, sauerkraut or grilled onions, a little fresher, a little brighter, and really delicious. So, you know, I humbly recommend that somebody from Wisconsin try that, just as a variation, but never lose the original. I mean, that's the gold standard.
Jamie, you've got us really hungry. We're just about out of time. What are you grilling next?
Well, actually, I'm about to do the Extreme Burger, which is the Weber Extreme Burger from Weber's Big Book of Burgers. Is a double-decker burger with bacon and guacamole and a special garlic mayonnaise and the lettuce and the tomato. It's just the over-the-top, you know, in-your-face, decadent, everything we love about a burger. So that is on my menu today.
I don't know if I'm quite that hungry. Jamie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Jamie Previance, the author of several cookbooks, including his latest called Weber's Big Book of Burgers. You can see Jamie's 5 Steps to Burger Brilliance on the Central Time Facebook page.
And while you're there, let us know. Have you gotten the grill out already? Or what are you planning to grill this weekend? Let us know on the Central Time Facebook page. By the way, coming up next week on Food Friday at this time, we'll talk about farm-to-table recipes featuring traditional and locally grown foods with the author of The Nourished Kitchen.